With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Velkommen til sesong 3 av podcastserien De som bygger det nye Norge. Produsert av Oslo Business Forum I samarbeid med Silvia Ceres.
Hei, og velkommen til dagens episode av De som bygger det nye Norge med Silvia Ceres og Oslo Business Forum. I dag I studio med oss har vi en god venn av meg, Frode Ødegård, eller Odegaard. Han har flyttet til Silicon Valley for veldig mange år siden, og har egentlig levd der mesteparten av livet sitt. Han norsk, altså, men mer komfortabel på engelsk, så vi kjører herfra på engelsk. Welcome, Frode.
Thanks, great to be here. It's been 27 years, so you have to forgive my Norwegian.
He understands everything in Norwegian, so you can't really, say anything you want, but he'll smile back whatever you say. That's a nice thing. Frode, I love it when you visit Oslo, because you're one of the really few people that I can have this super nerdy formal methods humor with that everybody else would just, you know, basically leave me immediately. We love talking about how formal methods have real relevance for the world today with its huge complexity, because they help us understand structure and the meaning of structure and then apply that to things like politics or organizations. And you have a super interesting anthropological view of this whole revolution happening now. So we'll spend most of our time talking about that. But before we get to that, I usually ask people to introduce themselves by saying a few personal words about who you are and why you are like you are.
Yeah, well, the latter is a big mystery maybe. But I was born here in town, actually. And went to high school in Norway, did my first software startup here, and then I left for Silicon Valley 27 years ago.
How old are you?
So I'll be 50 this summer. Wow. Which is pretty scary.
So like my hubby, yeah.
Yeah. So but I'm told I don't have the maturity of someone my age, so hopefully that's a good thing. So
What did you study? You don't like me asking this, but it's a great story.
No, it is kind of a, well, maybe it's not so common here, but
it's... say also how you moved to the U.S.
What's that?
How did you move to the U.S.?
Oh, well, what happened was when I did this software startup was to build development tools for embedded systems development, and I couldn't really find any venture capital here. And so...
How old were you?
So I was 22 then, and I'd already started traveling back and forth on a regular basis. I was on a couple of ISO standards committees by then. I was, you know, fairly active, traveling. So I'd started to get to know some people in the Valley. I knew that's where I wanted to go. So I closed the doors of my startup in Oslo, where I couldn't find any more capital, and, moved to the Valley. And then the year after,
I love how people from the Valley just say the Valley.
Yeah.
Imagine if we started just saying, you know, I wanted to move to the fjord. And so yeah. I moved to the fjord.
Well, in Silicon Valley, there's only one valley, but
I know.
So the valley is here.
Also, there is only one fjord. So
the valleys here are much prettier, but it is what it is. So, after a year, I won in the green card lottery, and I was all set. So, and I didn't come back for 7 years once I left. So it was.
You got money for your startup?
I didn't have to. I instead of doing another product company, I started sort of a miniature contract research and development company. And
what does that mean?
Well, I'd always admired from afar, like, your organizations like SRI, international, like the Stanford Research Institute and Xerox PARC and so on, which were bastions of you know, breakthrough innovation. And I wanted to have something like that myself. So I created a, you know, with a handful of people, kind of a micro version of that. And we did some cool things with applying, you know, very theoretical stuff in computer science to solving difficult problems in the industry.
How does that work?
Well, I can give you one example. So quite a while ago, people were very concerned about the Y2K crisis. So all this computer software was written, you know, with assuming that we'd have two digit years, and there was all this legacy software that had to be rewritten or
and the world would crash.
Yeah. And somehow the world didn't crash. And I still don't know if that was because the fears were exaggerated or because we were just so successful, everyone working
fixing
that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so that allowed me to use a lot of my understanding and passion for how to use mathematical logic and use sort of this more structured formal thinking to analyze how software systems and larger systems really function and then be able to change them in a safe way.
So you went from analyzing and understanding software systems to analyzing and understanding organizations.
Yeah. How
did that happen?
The way that came about was that I after a few years of doing the formal methods research stuff, I became more interested in helping organizations build better software in the first place. I did a lot of work with some, you know, larger companies like AT&T and Sony and so on. And of course, what I discovered was what everyone else has discovered was these organizations were often quite dysfunctional in terms of their structure, in terms of their culture, you know, the type of leadership they had.
And what does that mean, really? Too hierarchical, too stiff?
Too hierarchical, and just culturally, you know, people had difficulty, you know, just sharing bad news, and you get a lot of sort of not just direct fear, but sort of this passive aggressive behavior, and you know, you see this in companies all over the world. It's not just over there. So I started quickly realizing this is not just about not understanding the, you know, the engineering practices, and you know, it was deeper, more of a multidimensional problem. And so that's what got me interested in organizational design and organizational redesign, which I worked on for quite a while.
What really fascinates me is how you use everything from, you know, game theory and higher order functional programming to kind of try to understand the problem of structures in organizations, which really is sort of culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's I remember joking that even though I wasn't officially doing formal methods anymore, I was tricking people into doing formal methods by teaching them concepts in organizational design, yeah, which were basically application of these computer science ideas. And now you see people, you know, I think everyday people find themselves using these metaphors. Like people get overwhelmed, they'll tell you, you know, my inbox is full. And they're not just talking about their email inbox, they're talking about their brain.
Yeah. Right?
So these metaphors are kind of becoming more commonplace now. But the way organizations were designed originally hadn't changed a lot since the Bronze Age, right?
We'll get back to that.
So now things are more complex, and we need richer ideas to think about and how to describe and design organizations now than we used to.
These amazing network ideas for organizations. But let's get back to that. I just want you to say a few words about what you do now. So you're the founder and the CEO of Postlean Institute.
That's correct, yeah,
in Silicon Valley. And what is that?
So the Postlean Institute is a consulting and primarily research organization. And our mission is to reinvent management science, reinvent management thinking for this transition we're going through, which we think is a transition to a post-industrial economy and a post-industrial civilization. And most mainstream management thinking is still based on industrial era assumptions, maybe upgraded a little bit with IT, but that's still kind of the mindset that that permeates management thinking today.
So now let's get to the Bronze Age and what's wrong with the industrial way of managing things.
Well,
you have a really nice story about, you know, organizational history in 5 minutes, or 50 if you're given 50. Now you're given 5. How does that work?
Or maybe it won't take that long. I have a lot of practice now telling this. But essentially, we spent so the Postlean Institute came out of a predecessor company called Lean Systems Institute, and so I was heavily involved in taking these industrial era sort of state-of-the-art management ideas from places like Toyota, and that was lean thinking, which is also well known in Norway, and reinventing that for modern knowledge-based organizations. And after doing that with companies like Honeywell and Lockheed and some really large enterprises, we did that for 10 years, I sort of had this epiphany that there was a reason why it became harder and harder for these large companies to keep up with all the changes that were happening all around us. And it wasn't just about technology. It wasn't just about how they needed to come up with new, say, cloud-based business models or digital business models. There was something deeper. So I personally spent about a year doing a lot of reading of history, anthropology, and so on, and looking at how the way humans organize work and really sort of human economic history, how that's changed over time, going back to the old Stone Age or the Paleolithic, and then noticing that each time we went into a new anthropological era, there was basically some sort of idea or a tech disruption that caused that to happen. So, for example, 12,000 years ago, the first humans somewhere in southeastern and Turkey and northern Syria, today, started experimenting with part-time agriculture. And after a couple of thousand years, that became full-time agriculture. So we went from the Paleolithic to the Mesolithic. And that's also when we had, the first people started living in teepees. They have sort of pop-up villages. And then in the beginning of the Neolithic, when full-time agriculture began 10,000 years ago, people started building villages. And you see division of labor. The first silos, we talk about organizational silos. The first silos were corn silos. And then this is the origin of what you saw in much later in cultures as caste systems. You had specialization in, you have a religious function, so there's the priest caste. You have warriors who protect the crops. You have people who look after the livestock. That's also something that came with full-time agriculture. And you had the farmers and so on. And of course, someone had to make the pottery as well. Mm-hmm. So now then in the Bronze Age, of course, now you see an explosion of new technologies, which really form the backbone of all organizations since. The invention of writing systems, so now we could record knowledge in writing. I think the oldest tablet they found, which is a business letter, is someone complaining about a bad grain delivery. And how they still owe money.
They didn't start complaining about air conditioning systems yet.
No, not yet.
That came later.
That came a little bit later. And then they invented, accounting and written laws and court systems and kind of the whole way of organizing organizational bureaucracies. All of that's sort of what we have today, sort of a high-tech version of what existed in the Bronze Age.
So you're saying this was a way of dealing with complexity of the society that had to do all this specialized work?
Well, I think there was more complexity that came out of that as well. Mm. Growing human population, and eventually over time, people will think of new things, and then increasing population density, and the first cities were built, and so on. So then as you see in the Then you get about 1200 BC, you get the Bronze Age collapse. And part of that, aside from a volcano eruption, was someone figured out how to make iron swords. So that's the beginning of the Iron Age. And then that whole world in the Middle East, they went through...
Power reshuffle.
Yeah, there was a kind of a dark age. I mean, all the major civilizations basically temporarily sort of went under. And then what came after that was sort of the Greek revival, the invention of the Greek alphabet that we would recognize today, is the ancient Greek alphabet. And then you see another few centuries, and then you get thinkers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and the birth of scientific thinking and logic and all of this stuff.
So where does this take you to formal methods?
Well, that was really when people started using axiomatic thinking to reason about what was going on and kind of be able to separate, premises from conclusions and, having ways of arguing and so on. But you see this lead to eventually kind of after several centuries, to a sort of a scientific revolution. And in Europe, of course, we get, the rediscovery, you know, of Greek civilization. We get the Renaissance and the, you know, the Enlightenment and the, you know, the scientific revolution and also revolution around ideas of political and economic freedom. So we've taken for granted, you know, the generation that's grown up, you know, our generation, the fruits of the Industrial Revolution and then the sort of the IT revolution that began, you know, in this century. Rather in the last century, I forget which century it is now. and you know, things like you know, cheap mass production. You know, there's food available everywhere. You know, at least in the Western world. And now, because of the internet, now in this century, we have, you know, information at our fingertips, and we take that for granted. We're always connected, and all of this stuff. But we're about to undergo another big change.
Maybe bigger than all the other ones.
Well, as big as, you know, as big as the transition from say the Mesolithic to the Neolithic, or from the Paleolithic to the Mesolithic.
Why is it so big now?
Well, everyone thinks about new technology. Well, not everyone, but a lot of people think about new technology as being about sort of efficiency, right? And it's true. So there are things become you know, we can use today's rudimentary AI technology, you know, to automate things and
better, cheaper, safer.
Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of an incremental continuation of what we've had. That's been going on for decades. I mean, digitalization really started in the 1980s, right? So this is not a new thing, but it's the rewiring of the structure of industries.
And why does that happen now?
Well, it's because we have technology now that allows us to build organizations that are themselves sort of loosely coupled, just-in-time structures, and that allows to have these organizations to have business models where you can use the services of people, or you can make use of assets without owning those assets or employing those people. And of course, that's what business models like Airbnb and Uber and so on have shown.
Why is that so? Is it because you're not dependent on owning the labor force anymore, or the capital investments? It's right. All about data gathering, or where does this chain come about?
Yeah, it's all about really connecting the user or the end user, the buyer, with the asset or the service in a more capital efficient way. And the result of that is that industries, the shape of industries is changing dramatically. And if you are positioned in
because we're cutting out the middlemen.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And so you can see this happening with retail. You can see this happening in a whole bunch of industries where people realize that they can have the good or the service provided to them, you know, faster and more direct fashion. And also with physical production, you know, one of the side effects of the Industrial Revolution was this paradigm of centralized production, you know, for efficiency. And now what we're seeing with, you know, 3D printing is the first primitive version of this. You know, we're seeing on-site manufacturing of physical goods, you know, closer and closer to the point of use, the point of consumption. And so what's happening is over this period is you have the mastery of the world around us, you know, technology is improved and improved, and now it's really improving exponentially. At the same time, the trend towards top-down hierarchy and centralization, top-down management of resources, that suddenly is changing. We call that stratification and centralization. So whereas technology development is continuing to go up into the sky now even more, the stratification is collapsing. And it's a separation of these two trends for the first time. That is kind of the signal for why we're moving into a post-industrial era now.
We can basically work hyper-efficiently without all the middlemen now, that if we are able to gather enough data to build more sales cases. What I'm trying to get to is, so there is a structural change driven by new efficiencies in technology, but also that this is not only about one kind of technology. We talked a lot about the exponentiality of everything, really. Right. Why does that happen?
Well, you have to go back to the beginning of some fundamental technologies in the computer industry. You know, so computing capacity, communications capacity, storage capacity, but also any other fields, which is basically every field that rides on top of that stack, if you will. you know,
so
our
genetics.
Yeah,
our because we do digitally based DNA
sequencing. They're accelerated
as
well. Mm. Yeah, and then because of the internet, it's so much easier for the knowledge to spread, for people to collaborate. And that's another factor, you know, of how things accelerate. But it's not just about technology for efficiency. It's really about how we have this much more loosely coupled structure now, where anyone anywhere can sort of look at how an industry ticks, find out how they can capitalize on rewiring that industry. They can create a new business model around that, that benefits from that or causes that restructuring to happen. And they can be a global organization with a half a dozen people or a dozen people very, very rapidly.
So, Frode, you talk about rewiring organizations and industries. Mm-hmm. What about rewiring societies? Is that happening?
I don't think it's happening just yet. I think we're seeing maybe the beginning of it, and there is an economic aspect to that, of course, and there's a cultural aspect to it. I think in a lot of countries, you have regulatory frameworks that's holding that back somewhat. There's also an issue of mindset, of course, that people may be tied more to predictability, comfort, risk reduction in terms of how they live their lives and so on. But when you know your employer goes out of business, and the industry that you've spent 20 years of your career in looks dramatically different, then that's a signal for how, you know, something has really changed. And I saw a newspaper headline, I think it was Finansavisen or something, just a few days ago, where they predicted that, Norway would see the loss of 400,000 or 500,000 jobs in the next 10 to 15 years. It doesn't mean that there won't be new jobs created. But of course, there is there's a transition there when, new skills are going to be needed and so on. And this isn't just for people losing their jobs, for shareholders in those companies. Who will have, they will see loss of value as a result of this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I need to follow up on one thing there that I love discussing with you. And it's about, you need people with new skills. Mm-hmm. What should those skills be?
Well, there's a lot
Reason why we used to laugh about, we are programmers, both of us, at some level.
Yeah.
And we still laugh when people say they want to teach kids to code.
Yeah, and when I hear to code as a verb, I kind of shudder because ideally what you'd like people to learn if they're going to go into that is to do proper software engineering, which is a lot deeper than just...
What does that mean?
Well, it means... Engineering is really about applying scientific knowledge to solve practical problems under economic and time constraints, right? So if you're designing a bridge, there's physics involved. You have to understand what the load bearing capacity of the bridge is going to be. You have to do some safety calculations. You have to build models. You're not you're not attending a weekend boot camp. This is a serious project. Human lives depend on this and so on. Well, it's the same thing with software. People have died from buggy software. You have medical devices that don't function properly and so on. So I think that developing software, especially now that we have much more complex systems that are interacting, you have drones, very soon you're going to have drones flying around. You have all kinds of stuff happening, real time. These systems need to be safe. They need to function. And this idea that people can just kind of attend the boot camp and somehow they've mastered this is sort of ridiculous to me. But what people really need to do is to invest long-term in themselves, learning more about science, learning more about the engineering, learning more about history, learning more about how the world functions.
How things work.
Yeah, how on different levels. Yeah, and develop a curiosity around that. And that's not just something you do in university or in school. It's how to live your life, basically. Mm-hmm. Right.
I read recently a book called Algorithms to Live By, And I loved it. We didn't have time to talk about this offline, but basically it's about, two Stanford professors, young guys, explain the most important algorithms we have in programming, but applied to real life problems that people normally wouldn't solve with a computer. So, you know, how to find a perfect match, life partner, or, you know, how to do organizational design. The first one is really an example of something well known in computer science called the secretary problem. And the other one is game theory. Internet design. Game theory comes in when you try to explain some of the forces in society. And, you know, Nash equilibria and all of this stuff that you thought was super theoretical was right. So beautifully explained as a part of thinking in a structured way about solving some of the most complex problems in your life.
Right.
And I was just thinking, I wish I read this when I was, you know, 20, not now.
Well, I think this idea that a lot of these algorithms are very abstract and sort of hard to understand. It's not something that comes from their origin, because if, for example, for game theory, if you read the first paper on game theory that was co-authored by von Neumann, I believe, the folks back then were really, and so we're talking 1940s, I believe, and so the folks back then were really focused on solving very practical sort of engineering problems, and they just needed new ways to think about that. And then it was only later, when you have sort of the next generation of academics or people working in the field, where they try to generalize it to make it more abstract, and suddenly it becomes a sort of mysterious thing. So I think the best course of action always is to go back to the original source.
What was the problem they were trying to solve?
I don't even remember now, which is embarrassing.
No, but I'm saying, asking what the problem was helps you understand the basic philosophy of the thing.
Yeah. So if you want to understand a field, I think reading a bit about the history of the field, I think is very helpful. I keep coming back to history, how helpful that is to both intellectual history and sort of the history of humanity, in general, and how, you know, the big story, right? How we came to be, and that coupled with understanding of how our world is changing now as a result of technology, but not just sort of on the business surface. And certainly leaders and investors, you know, they have huge challenges now because of all this restructuring that's happening in industries, and how their own organizations have to be tremendously restructured to cope with this. But there's a bigger stage here. There's a bigger picture involved, and that's the story of humanity itself and where humanity is heading.
By the way, I love also how these guys who came up with the most kind of complex and abstract solutions are often super interesting and warm and eccentric human beings as well. John Neumann, I love one of his quotes saying, how mathematicians are actually machines for, or automatons for, converting coffee into theorems.
Yes, that's one of my favorites too.
You talk about this value stack in current companies or industries. Can you say a few words about that?
Sure. Yeah, so as part of our work on this new management science, which we call post-lean thinking.
By the way, why post-lean?
Oh, it's just because mainstream, you know, some of the state-of-the-art ideas in mainstream management science are really based around this lean school, which, again, I think is very well known in Norway, which is all about long-lasting organizations, preferably, long employee tenures, investing in people for the future, empowering people by teaching them to be problem solvers, and just sort of strategically and patiently working at incrementally innovating what you offer to the customers.
Innovating incrementally but fast.
Incrementally but hopefully fast. And you saw also this with Lean Startup, which is kind of the startup flavor of it. Looking for opportunities out there to create value, experimenting with different value propositions, and then on the engineering side, experimenting with how you're going to make it work. But what we found after, you know, a decade of doing that, with mostly larger complex enterprises, was the world was moving so much faster, and so you needed a more discontinuous type of innovation, and so we noticed how industry structures were changing. We noticed how organizational structures were changing or needed to change, and so we had to come up with models. We had to come up with practical management tools, and the value stack model, and we have a newer one now called the value graph, are ways of looking at the structure of industries and being able to kind of make sense of what the shapes of those structures are and how they're changing. So the value stack is a way of looking at industries in layers. So
give us an example.
Well, so if think about the you think about the retail industry, right? So you have so let's say you're a toy store. So you're buying toys. Somewhere there are places that are manufacturing those toys, and in the value stack, those manufacturers are in the what we call the production, construction end of the value stack. That's a bottom layer in the model. And if you are, and also like in the construction industry, you have companies that are building physical things. Those activities tend not to be that capital efficient, right? Then you have, let's say that you own, you have a whole bunch of toy stores that you own. And so you think of them as assets. You're trying to get the most out of your assets. So then you are really kind of in the asset management layer, just like airlines are. You know, you have all these airplanes, you have to sell seats, you have to improve your asset utilization. And then you have a step above from there, you have manual services. So if you have a cleaning company or have a management consulting company, you're selling services that are, done manually. And those kind of are the bottom three layers of the value stack. But what we see now is new ventures are being built that have digital business models. So we have the digital content layer, the value stack. That's where Hulu and Netflix and so on live, and Spotify and iTunes. And then you have the automated services. So that's where, if you have a startup like, Salesforce, no longer such a startup, but Salesforce.com or smaller startups, they're basically providing automated services delivered, over the cloud. And then if you look at what Airbnb and Uber and these marketplace organizations are doing, they live in the next two layers in the stack, which we call the interface and marketplace layers. The interface layer is where you aggregate, you organize access to people, to things, to assets and services in the economy. And when you've done that, you can put them into an online marketplace, which then your customers can take advantage of, and you become a gateway to those products and those services and assets. And then, of course, what's happened more recently is we have the beginning now of intelligent agents that can orchestrate commerce and curate products and services on your behalf. So and this is kind of old news now, but up till 9 months ago or so, I would bring with me a little box.
Alexa.
Yeah. Mm. I would bring with me an Echo that ran Alexa, and I would put it on stage. And at some point, during my keynote, I would accidentally order something or just have a little conversation with it and so on. And what we tell people is you have to be aware of where in the value stack you're positioned. So if you are, if you are below the marketplace and interface layers, chances are that someone else will have a gateway that goes to you, and that's how the customers will find you.
And they will cut into your margins or control your ability to price.
You essentially have to compromise. You have to have some sort of distribution solution for people to find you, right? But now what's happening is the machine to human marketplaces that marketplace organizations provide will probably be transitioned to machine to machine marketplaces, where you will have an agent that talks to the consumer. And that shifts the whole balance of power in terms of branding, because there's only going to be so many agents that we can talk to, because there are only so many brands that we can remember and care about. And so increasingly we will use these intelligent agents to help us, help us orchestrate our lives, essentially. And they will go out there and they will find
They will know better than we do.
Well, and they will. We won't necessarily have the time.
Yeah.
This
brings us to an interesting discussion about basically where does this lead us with free will or, something other than efficiencies. But we don't have time for that, Frode. We won't go there now.
More delegation. I mean, you can imagine by looking at the patterns of behaviors in your life, you can imagine AIs figuring out what you might want or what you would like. Mm-hmm. You can now apply that to a lot of the product development process, and you can get some suggestions for, And I see you complain about your chair a lot. Well, here are some design ideas for a chair. Which one would you like?
Yeah, I know. And then it can be manufactured and sent to you just in time. Humans are consistent and logical, and we know we're not. So that's what I'm worried about. Mm. You know, a system that actually makes me into a consistent data point, which would be terrible.
I think it's the opposite direction. I think it's going to be more responsive, more individualized by observing you, as opposed to trying to. Because it's the opposite of mass production, right? It's individualized, just-in-time production. In individualized, just-in-time satisfaction of your needs. That's where we're heading.
Yeah, I know. So. But say, you know, it's the 1st of January. You decide I'm going to be so healthy this year and I'll go to the gym and, you know, no more mm-hmm. pizza. And then 3rd of January, say, I'm really tired. Today I'm staying in. I'm tuning in Netflix and, you know, I want the pizza.
Yeah.
And then your Alexa says, no way. You know, you go.
Right.
And I wouldn't want that, I think.
Yeah,
but it's good for me, but I'm not sure that I like it.
I think different people desire or require different levels of
tuning.
Strictness with that. Yeah, So I think it can be for some people it can be good for them.
Yeah.
We'll
go and drink some wine and then discuss some more offline. What I want you to say a few words about is. You talk about the new management science. So if you had to summarize that in a few sentences, what would it be?
Well, it's really looking at what happens to management thinking when all of the industrial era assumptions we've grown up with go out the window. So what you end up with instead of long-lasting, stable sort of strategic organizations, you end up with this network of micro, just-in-time, short-lived micro-organizations. And this network, or this we call it the value graph, much of the governance that happens there will probably be done using AI to leverage a lot of routine governance type of decisions. And where we start realizing that there's a lot of value that can be captured from being the cause of or taking advantage of the restructuring of industries to improve their capital efficiency. And for humans, you know, for in terms of our culture and what the sort of human experience is going to be, it's really going to be a world where in a post-industrial culture, where we have minute control over our biology and over matter, the way we control software today. And so basically instant satisfaction of our needs and desires, and where humans are going to work more on doing creative stuff that have meaning for us, whether it's STEM or whether it's art, exploration, all of this stuff, and all the boring, repetitive stuff, unless you want to do boring, repetitive stuff, then you know will be done by machines increasingly, and I think this is a transition we're looking at during the course of you know of the next this decade and the next and the one after that and the one after that. So 40, 50 years is kind of what we're looking at.
So as a part of this, you also talk about how we need to lead in different ways. It's you know organizations as organisms, the whole emergence kind of thinking. Can you say a few words about that?
Yeah, so there it's really interesting that the. It's actually quite an old idea to look at organizations like machines a little bit. And now that's coming back somewhat. In the 50s and 60s, people started looking at 1950s and 60s, I should say. People started looking more at organizations as sort of social systems. And of course, both views are true. They're socio-technical organisms, if you will. But because the structure and the lifespan of those organizations is changing so dramatically, leadership has to change too. And we know that, for example, motivating people through goals and all of this stuff really works. But the time span shrinks and you won't be working with the same people for such a long time anymore. So you're looking at much more just-in-time team formation and putting people together for whatever is the mission of the quarter of this year. At the most. And that's going to mean that leaders have to become more emotionally agile, I think. And they also have to be much closer to the action than before. We won't have this sort of hierarchy anymore. We'll have networks, whether it's inside of large organizations, and gradually they will become more open, loosely coupled networks too, or across organizations.
And so leaders going around randomly pestering people? Or
No, the random routine management work will all be done by AIs, like project scheduling, follow-up on, are you done yet? Are you done yet? You know, all that stuff goes away. That's really more management than leadership anyway. But for leadership, it's really going to be focusing on are we working on the right things and do we understand together? Are we learning together about how the world is changing and how we're going to be part of that? And I think that just means that that, you know, there's no hiding anymore as a leader. If you don't have the domain knowledge to understand on the sort of the science engineering level, what is concretely that you're changing the world outside, then you won't be able to contribute as much value. And I think so there are a lot of people who are comfortable leaders working in very abstract levels today, who will not be as comfortable in their future. So I think organizational leadership is going to be a lot more like running a startup, even in large organizations, than it is today. And a lot of organizations today, leaders are more administrators than leaders.
So. What about when you do these workshops, you get people to understand some kind of patterns. Mm-hmm. You talk about organizations as higher order functions. What can you say that very briefly?
Oh, yeah. So high order functions or high order programs is just a concept from theoretical computer science. And it just means you can imagine you have a function or program that just creates another program. As opposed to returning a number or something like that. So, and the idea of high order organizations, it came to me because it was obvious that larger firms needed to rearrange themselves, restructure themselves to become platforms for creating new ventures, new disruptive ventures of their own, because a lot of large companies now are playing defense, right? They're being disrupted. They're trying to respond, but they're not set up to attract, young innovators, because young innovators said, might as well go do their own startup. It's a lot more fun than work for a big, boring company. If they compensate people as, normal employees, that sort of employee-employer relationship doesn't really fit with the culture where people are willing and able to take risk and try new things. And so we came up with this sort of organizational design pattern, which we call a higher order organization, where an organization becomes a platform for recruiting innovators from the outside, having a compensation arrangement with them where they basically become co-founders of the new ventures they help create. And then using the value stack and the value graph as a way of scanning industries to understand how the structure of those industries are changing. And then based on that, forming ideas for new disruptive ventures. And when those ventures mature to a certain point, they might be spun off from the parent. And of course, the innovators who helped you build that venture, they will make out really well. And then you might have, instead of a guaranteed job safety or expectations of long employee tenures, maybe you will have a maximum employee tenure. So you get 2 years to make your mark.
Time to go.
Yeah, and then, so then you sort of graduate, right?
So graduating from companies, that's actually a lovely idea.
And honestly, in a lot of places, people do that anyway. Like General Electric will move you around. It's up or out, every 18 months, 24 months.
Out is the best outcome, basically, what you're saying.
Well, but out, not in the sense of getting fired, but
yeah,
but you're sort of, you can have an option where people, you could re-up, right? So they
do that in the military. That's a new idea for unions.
Yeah, well, unions is, that's a whole other fun chapter of speaking of organizations being disrupted.
You actually do have a nice positive vision for unions.
Yeah.
Say what it is.
Well, the idea of organizations as separate legal entities, really begins in the Roman Empire. That's the origin of corporates and corporations, right? So they had bylaws and everything. And then in medieval Europe...
It means a body.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So in medieval Europe, you had these guilds, right? Which and also even back in Rome, you had guilds. And so that was a type of body that kind of organized labor that had... a certain specialty, whether they were cutting hair or making pottery, whatever their specialty was. And unions then, in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution, became partially a way to sort of organize salary negotiation with employers, partially a source of sort of social welfare before the state took over those functions. And actually, there were industrialists like in the States, like Andrew Carnegie, who encouraged the formation of unions. And he was supportive of literacy programs for workers and so on. And then eventually you had this sort of atmosphere of us versus them, which I think certainly my generation here in Norway grew up with that. And unions is sort of the even with protection through labor regulations, as source of labor and so on. Well, a lot of the jobs that were traditional union jobs are kind of going away, and the lifespan of organizations are shrinking. So maybe it's time to go back to this sort of guild model where...
Which really develops its members.
Yeah, where you develop members, and then of course unions now have to compete, and they could even be for-profit entities. And so if you're a member of this guild, you know, they might help you with some certifications. Maybe that, that guild has a trusted brand. And then they serve their members essentially by preparing them for the future, or rather for the current disruption that's happening. But the idea of sort of unions versus employers, you know, it's really a false conflict. I mean, the and I think both, not just unions, but employers' organizations too, will face sort of a similar disruption threat. I mean, why do you, if you're building startups that can become global companies with 11, 12 employees, and you know, think of Instagram being acquired for $1 billion with 13 people, right? Why do you need a large employer organization? You know, they're relevant. They're both relics from an industrial era. So all that stuff will go away.
We need jobs. We need middle class, my dear.
Well, we do, but it's going to be much more about self-organizing to create your own jobs. And because firms will not need as many people anymore to do the same kinds of things because of automation and AI and so on, it means that a much larger percentage of the population will be founding their own ventures. So in a way, one way that we've summarized this, and I mentioned this in my keynotes, is we're kind of going back to a very high-tech version of the Mesolithic. You know, before everything became settled down and static, when we were agile, we were moving around, when we had pop-up villages, and you know, but think of that, but with nanotechnology and AI. That's really what the post-industrial transition is about. So it's going to be a fun century ahead.
Except men have to watch out now because of Me Too. But we won't go there now.
everyone has to watch out for bad behavior when you have an increasingly open culture because of real-time media that everyone's linked into everywhere. And this is just kind of the current example of that. But you're going to see any kind of corporate misbehavior, any kind of dishonest dealings. You know, you see you know, with its ranking Uber drivers, and you get a bad ranking, you know, below 4, you can't pick up any passenger suddenly anymore. Or if you're a passenger and you behave badly, nobody will come, you know, you won't be able to get a car to come pick you up anymore. So this sort of putting it out in the open, I think, is also part of the cultural transition that we're going through. And I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. Trude, I knew we were going to run out of time, and so we did. But I still need to ask you the two final questions.
Sure.
First of all, do you have any policy advice for, you know, increased innovation throughout the society?
Yeah.
We need to make it short.
The old paradigm of industrial policy was really based around projections and central planning and control, or at least having a strong centralized vision of which way the economy should develop. And so people talk about, you know, traditional strong areas for Norway and the same thing in other countries. I think it's unrealistic. I think the best way is to deregulate from a perspective of positioning yourself to be as agile as possible, and understanding that the people who really are building the country are the people who are creating the new disruptive ventures, and you should welcome them, not put barriers that make it hard for them to build those ventures and exit. And that means all the things that people, that entrepreneurs complain about, you know, in different countries. Like here, people talk about the options taxation and all of that stuff, and Arbeidsmiljøloven and so on. All that stuff really needs to be looked at. And I think instead of having a cautious defensive posture, I think celebrating those young people who really are going to be building the new Norway, I think is extremely important for policymakers. And look at Estonia. I mean, they're number, 7 on the Economic Freedom Index. Norway is way down. So you can compare Norway to a former Soviet republic, and you can actually learn from them. And I talk to people here in Oslo who go to Estonia. One really awesome guy that I met with is Fredrik Winter. And we just met on Friday for the first time. And he said that they came back from Estonia and they were all inspired. And people from the US are visiting Estonia and learning from them. So the all powers are not necessarily going to dominate within the country, nor are the countries that did well in the past. Like, people look at America and there's a lot of entrepreneurial things about America that are great, but people shouldn't assume that Silicon Valley will be will be leading all of the stuff forever. I mean, I think it's all up for grabs for everyone. And so it's up to policymakers in every country to pursue those opportunities aggressively and think of their countries as potential platforms for innovation globally, as a global fountain of innovation and wealth and all sorts of good stuff, as opposed to just thinking about what can we do inside our own country.
Final question. Your best advice. You get to choose to whom.
Oh, gosh. Well, we talk
to
about...
me.
Yes.
If you don't hurry up, that will be a question.
Well, I would say to folks who run mature companies is you need to reorganize to attract young innovators and become a platform for future innovation. And you need to move a lot faster than you're moving. And they should know that already, but if they don't, this is my reminder. So,
what about everybody else?
Learn more about, don't just learn how to code, learn how things work. Get curious about STEM, get curious about history, how the world works, where the world is going. Read everything that you can get your hands on, all directions, become curious.
I love your curiosity. I love how you connect very unusual fields. And it's really always an inspiring pleasure, actually, to chat with you when you come over here to enjoy some of our nice winter weather, having all your Californian sun. So, Frode, thanks for inspiring and thanks for visiting with us in this podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening.
Tusen takk for at du hørte på podcastserien De som bygger det nye Norge. For flere episoder og annet innhold, gå inn på obforum.no.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.